Spring in Austin, Texas, is normally a beautiful time of year. The heat isn't nearly as intense, vibrant bluebonnets and wildflowers are blooming, and the huge festival here, South by Southwest, is just wrapping up. The city is warm, buzzing, and alive. But in March of 2018, residents of Austin would be afraid to open their doors.
911, do you need...
Hey, I don't know what's going on. My neighbor, something exploded or something. There's blood everywhere. We need an ambulance immediately.
That's the 911. Do you need police, fire, EMS?
Oh, I need a EMS, please.
Okay, hold on.
Something exploded. Hello?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah,
can you... Okay. They're on their way. This has not slowed them down at all. The two people are not hurt. Are they having any difficulty breathing?
Yes, my grandson.
Okay. Does he have difficulty speaking between breaths?
Yeah, he's moaning.
Okay. What parts of the body were burned or injured?
Yes, everybody. We got two people injured here, please.
Okay. What part of the body?
Hands, face. I don't know. I got blood all over my house. They opened a package and it exploded from outside.
Today, I'm going to tell you about a 19-day reign of terror that paralyzed one of America's fastest-growing cities. We're going back to an event that left behind questions that still haunt investigators and the community today. Today's perplexing episode is all about the Austin serial bombings. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Kadra. If you're new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you end up enjoying today's episode all about the Austin serial bombings, I would love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener, hello, my friends, and welcome back. I'm happy you're here today. This topic was actually requested by my mom, and for you guys who listen regularly, you might remember my mom is a patron. She is a Perplexed Society Supreme Leader, meaning she is at the highest tier. She is an OG listener. She's super supportive, and patrons get prioritized, and of course, my mom. Come on, guys, is going to get prioritized. So my mom actually heard about the story when she was watching a show on Paramount Plus called FBI True. And so I watched it and was like, yeah, wow, this is crazy. And this all happened in Austin, where I've been living for the last several years. I had never heard of this story. And as we go through, you're going to be like, wow, that's crazy that she had never heard of this, because this is a huge story. So thank you to my mom, Rilena, for requesting. If you guys would want to see the footage for this whole case, pictures, then I would highly recommend you watch this episode, or it's two episodes. It's season 8, episodes 8 and 9 of FBI True, and you can watch it on Paramount Plus. It's also on Amazon Prime, and I think it's on YouTube also. I also want to plug one more recommendation for this episode. When I was researching, it was pretty difficult to find information on the victims, which was very frustrating because obviously it's very important that we talk about them and honor them. So I found this podcast called Darkness, and it's a smaller podcast. They did an entire season about the Austin serial bombings. They interviewed family, law enforcement. There's a bunch of audio in their episodes of like press conferences, 911 calls. So it was very helpful. They had a lot of detailed information about the victims. So it's their 2021 season. It's the Darkness podcast. So if this case grips you and you want to learn more, I would definitely recommend that you check them out. Okay, last thing, just a couple quick shout outs and then we will get right into today's episode. I recorded a while back, so I'm on a little bit of a backlog. So I wanted to welcome my newest patrons. Welcome to the Perplexed Society, Augustina M.K., and welcome to the Perplexed Society, Christy C. I hope you guys are enjoying those early ad-free episodes. Augustina, you joined at tier two, so you're also going to get a bunch of bonus content and some stickers in the mail from me. And Augustina, I believe, is all the way from Argentina, if I'm remembering correctly, which is amazing. So I'm super happy to have you guys. Thank you for supporting the show. And then also thank you to Alex for buying a coffee. And Alex said, great job. I hope that you're doing well. And yes, I am doing well. So thank you, Alex. You guys can always check out those support links down in the episode description. I also was just on an episode of Cryptid Cocktail Party, and me and Dave had such a good time over there. We talked all about the Hodag. I might drop that episode on here in a couple months as like a feed drop, but it was so much fun. It was hilarious. I would highly recommend that you go listen to that on their feed and check out their show, Cryptid Cocktail Party. They do a great job. All the sources I use for today's episode will be down in the show notes. Also, trigger warning, this is a very disturbing story, so take care of yourselves while listening.
Audio depicting the sound of explosions will be played throughout this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Without further ado, let's dive right into this case, the story of the Austin serial bombings. It's early morning on March 2nd, 2018. The sun is just coming up over northeast Austin. In this area sits a quaint neighborhood called Harris Ridge. The streets are lined with modest homes and old trees. It's the kind of neighborhood where people know each other. In this neighborhood is 39-year-old Anthony Stephan House, who goes by Stephan. Stephan's getting his 8-year-old daughter ready for school. He was a hardworking African-American construction worker. He was married, a former athlete, and graduated from Texas State University with his degree in finance. Stephan was described as being quiet, humble, well-liked, and self-assured. On this morning, Stephan would step outside on his front porch to smoke a cigarette. Something he did every morning. This was his ritual. So he steps outside, his daughter's still getting ready for school, and at his feet, he sees a cardboard box waiting for him. He picks it up, unassuming. It explodes. This blast was powerful enough to spray shrapnel and debris throughout the area and damage this entire side of Stephan's house. Stephan collapses to the ground, face down. His wife, Shannon, was not in the house at this time. She was at work, but his daughter had been getting ready for school. And from the sources that I could find, my understanding is his daughter witnessed this entire event. Stephan's neighbor, Sean Phillips, heard the explosion and quickly called 911. He had been helping his kids get ready for school when he heard what he described as, quote, the loudest, most shocking noise I have likely ever heard. I can only describe it as sounding like a Mack truck had just hit a trash dumpster. So Sean tells 911 dispatch the explosion had come from his neighbor's porch. He runs outside, he's trying to figure out what's going on, and he sees Stephan unresponsive and face down. Stephan was still alive at this point. Sean would later say Stephan's hands were nearly blown off and the porch was covered in blood. Sean was also attempting to help Stephan. He gave him 2 rescue breaths, all the while listening to Stephan's daughter screaming, "My daddy is dead. My daddy is dead." Another neighbor came out at this point, took Stephan's daughter into their house so that she wouldn't have to witness anything else, and investigators would quickly arrive on scene. There was a bomb squad, local police, an ambulance, and the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Division, or the ATF. The FBI was also notified because this was a bomb, so they have to rule out terrorism. This scene was completely chaotic. Investigators were interviewing neighbors also. They're checking the street and doorbell cameras for surveillance footage. And inside of this bomb, there were AC Delco batteries, which the bomb squad found strange. They said these are not batteries that you would typically use to make something like this. There were also pieces of a mouse trap, which is how it detonated. And there were screws, which had been manually added to this pipe bomb to increase the severity of the blast. In the hours that followed, the Austin PD assistant chief, Joseph Chacon, told residents in a press conference there was no reason to worry. At this time, they really seemed to think that this was an isolated event. And I can like kind of see that, but I don't think that you should like be so quickly telling the public not to worry. You hear this a lot in cases like this. Oh, we don't want people to panic. It can end up causing more harm because then people aren't prepared. You know, you don't know that they have no reason to worry at this point. So why are you telling them that? The other insane, horrible thing was that Chief Joseph Chacon also floated the possibility that Stefan might have built this bomb himself and accidentally detonated it. Just an insanely horrible, irresponsible comment that would obviously deeply upset Stefan's loved ones. And again, why are you floating that possibility when this just happened? You don't know what happened. Police also theorized Stefan may have been an unintended victim. Perhaps he was caught in the crossfire of some local drug dispute. This is similar to one of the theories from the Blount family bombing that I covered a while back, if you guys remember, that bomb that killed that entire family in their trailer in Azle, Texas. Police also dug into Stefan's background, including his finances, looking for any possible motive for his murder, but they couldn't find anything. It seemed like whoever hurt Stefan either did it by mistake or it was random. Stefan would later pass away in the hospital. Nobody was told at this time to watch out for suspicious packages on their doorsteps. Nobody was connecting Stefan House's murder to a larger threat. It seemed like this was an isolated incident, and at this time, there wasn't any clear confirmation of domestic terrorism. So the Austin Police Department continued to lead this investigation, and the FBI, who had a lot more resources, had to follow. But all of this would soon change. Just 10 days later, on March 12, 2018, at 6:44 in the morning, another package bomb detonated at a home. This time, it was in Old Fort Hill on East MLK Boulevard. This is a neighborhood in Austin's predominantly Black East Side. And inside this home was a 17-year-old boy named Draylen Mason, his mother Shamika Wilson, and Draylen's grandmother. Draylen was a senior at East Austin College Prep. He was a very talented musician with multiple scholarship opportunities. He had been accepted to the University of North Texas and the University of Texas and to their music programs. I can speak to the University of North Texas program because it's right by the college that I went to. They have a very prestigious, very talented music school. So obviously, Draylen was very bright, very, very talented. He was an incredible double bassist. He was very well liked, and he also had a lot going for himself. He was a busy young man. He performed in several chamber and mariachi groups to bring art and music to low-income communities. He was principal chair in the Austin Youth Orchestra, and he also had dreams of doing neurosurgery. But now he had gotten this acceptance into the Butler School of Music at UT Austin. And Draylen was described as being someone you could laugh with, being very kind, and just radiating positivity. At the young age of 13, Draylen even won a contest, showcasing an essay he wrote about racial profiling in his community. So on this day, March 12th, Draylen goes out to his porch and he finds a cardboard box. He brings it inside and he tells his mother, Shamika, that the package looks suspicious, but it had their address handwritten in Sharpie on the top. So Shamika opens the package in their kitchen. Draylen is standing there with her, and the way that the package was positioned, the bomb detonated and Draylen would absorb the majority of the blast. Shamika would later be taken to the hospital and would survive. Draylen did not. Draylen's grandmother quickly dialed 911 as Draylen wandered, confused around the house and in pain, moaning and slowly bleeding out. This crime scene would also be very difficult for investigators to analyze. It was like working through the aftermath of a tornado. This was different from Stefan because this happened on a porch. They don't have all these items that they have to sift through, but this was a kitchen. So all the components of this bomb had mixed with various items in the family's kitchen. It took a while, but the investigators did locate multiple pieces of pipe and AC Delco batteries, the same batteries that were used in the bomb that killed Stefan. Shamika goes to the hospital. A surgeon has to remove nails and bolts from all over her body. And I cannot imagine how her and Draylen's grandmother were feeling. Police held a press conference urging citizens to now be on the lookout for any mysterious packages and to call 911. And just about 5 hours later, at 11:50 a.m., just a 5-minute drive away from the house with Draylen Mason and Shamika Wilson's attacks, a third bomb goes off. This time it's in the Montopolis neighborhood on Galindo Street. The victim was a 75-year-old woman named Esperanza Herrera. She was visiting and taking care of her elderly grandparents, as she did every day. When she arrived, Esperanza noticed a package on her parents' porch with a handwritten address. But this was actually the address across the street. So obviously, Esperanza thought it was dropped there by mistake, and she was actually in the middle of taking it over to her neighbor's house. She was outside when the bomb detonated. And the difference with this explosion is that Esperanza was in a much more open area. And so it's believed by experts this is what saved her life. She didn't absorb this contained, intense blast. It was able to spread out. She was still injured, though, and had to go get medical care. At this point, this is the third bombing now in the last few weeks. Close to 500 agents arrived on the scene, and they were picking up shrapnel off of roofs hundreds of feet away. That's how powerful this blast was. The FBI would determine this bomb, just like the others, had AC Delco batteries and a similar design. So just to recap, at this point, there have now been 3 attacks. There are 2 deceased. One is a 17-year-old, and there are 2 others that have been seriously injured. The police are now realizing they have a serial bomber attacking Austin's east side. And they were also thinking that these were hate crimes because all of these victims were people of color. Not to mention, there's a connection between Stefan House and Draylen Mason. So Stefan House's father was actually close friends with Draylen Mason's grandfather. Both of these older men attended the same local church, and they were also prominent figures in Austin's African-American community. So Austin police were now officially linking these attacks together. And the FBI set up a task force at the Austin-Travis County Emergency Operations Center. The investigators feared where the bomber would strike next. Austin is also a very busy city. There were a lot of big events coming up in the area. The Final Four was going to be happening soon, along with South by Southwest, one of the biggest festivals that Austin does every year. It draws in hundreds of thousands of people. And Rodeo Austin was bringing in about 25,000 people a night. So what if this bomber was escalating and planning something much bigger? Investigators combed through the surveillance footage that they had gathered from different streets and doorbell cameras, and they were able to hone in on 4 persons of interest. The first POI was a man with a Navy background who had experience in explosive ordnance disposal, and he also worked in construction, so he would have had access to a lot of the materials that were used to construct these pipe bombs. The second POI was actually this man's son, and some racist remarks were found on both of their social media pages. The other 2 POIs, they don't say much about at all in the sources that I could find. They just mentioned that both of these individuals had been in all of these areas at the time of the bombings based on cell phone data. So at this point, police were floating the possibility that this could be one bomber or multiple. By March 15th, local activists were raising questions about the pace of the investigation. The bombs had targeted predominantly poorer Black and Latino neighborhoods. Some people in the community understandably felt like the police response had been slow, that the warnings had come too late, and they wondered if things would have been different if these packages had been left on the doorsteps of wealthier, whiter neighborhoods. 6 days later, on the evening of March 18th, at 8:32 p.m., in a residential neighborhood in southwest Austin, there would be another bombing. Two young men, 22 and 23 years old, were walking along a sidewalk on Dong Song Drive when they triggered a bomb hidden along the sidewalk with a tripwire made of fishing line. This device was attached to a sign that read, "Drive like your kids, live here." Both victims, William Grote and Colton Maths, suffered serious injuries, but both survived. And again, I think this is because they were outside, so they didn't get this contained as intense blast. For investigators, this attack was different. This was just out in public. This was also really random. It was a predominantly white neighborhood. Police had also been surveying those four POIs, and none of them were in the area when this attack on William Grote and Colton Maths occurred. So now, all of these theories bring police back to square one. They don't have a suspect, and they're not thinking at this point that this is racially motivated anymore, because this is a white neighborhood and it was completely random. After this attack, police went public immediately, saying that Austin had a serial bomber and there was a high level of sophistication and skill. This is when the community really went into panic. There's been four attacks now. After this attack, police would get more than 1,200 calls about any suspicious packages that were on people's doorsteps. Every package was a threat. It didn't matter if you had ordered something. Everyone was terrified to open a package. A bomb threat was also sent during this time to a Live Nation music event, and this led to performances by Ludacris and The Roots being canceled. Additional threats were also made by phone to the eBay customer service center in Austin. It was later found that these threats that were made via phone call were apparently unrelated to all these other bombings. The day after these threats were made, there was an arrest of a 26-year-old man named Trevor Weldon. So he was arrested and charged for making terroristic threats and committing a third-degree felony. But my understanding is he didn't actually attack anyone. He just made these extremely stupid threats. But they never connected Trevor Weldon to any of these other attacks. So this suspect for all these other bombings was still at large. Just after midnight on March 20th, a package detonated inside a FedEx ground facility in Skirts, Texas, northeast of San Antonio. This did end up injuring one employee, but they did survive. This is now, again, so random. Like, we've gone from houses to a wide open neighborhood and now to a FedEx facility. This was the largest crime scene in this case that investigators would have to work through, because this was a massive FedEx facility. It was 100,000 square feet. Employees would process thousands of packages there every day. This was pretty far away, like I would say probably a few hours. So had the bomber moved to a new area? Why were they attacking a FedEx facility? So the FBI didn't really know what to do other than to start x-raying every package. And eventually they did find the package. They were able to determine it was being mailed to a spa manager, a white female, in Austin. So this guy was continuing to attack in Austin, but I guess the way that the packages had routed, it ended up here. There was also a second package that was intercepted hours later before it exploded that was being mailed to an Austin area pastor who was also a white male. The package was found and safely disarmed at another FedEx facility in southeast Austin. So my whole thing with this is, if you know how easy it is for these packages to explode, why in the fuck would you take them to a packaging facility? It's like this guy doesn't care at all. Who touches these packages, who gets hurt, where it happens. It's very wild and terrifying. It's just like completely disorganized. This person does not care at all what happens. And now investigators were able to determine where these packages had been shipped from. So this bomber is getting sloppy. So the FBI determined both of these packages had come from the same FedEx store in Sunset Valley and an Austin suburb. This FedEx was also right next to the bombing that had happened on Dong Song Avenue, involving the two young men walking outside. Investigators, of course, go to this Sunset Valley FedEx store. They talk to the clerk. They pull surveillance footage to see who had dropped these packages off. When the clerk pulled the surveillance from March 18th, they see their suspect. This was a man wearing a ball cap, a blonde wig, and red palmed gloves. He was clearly seen dropping off the two packages at 4 p.m. The man was also wearing multiple shirts to make himself appear bigger than he was. He was a scrawny little creep. And he was completely cool and calm while he's dropping off these explosives. I really feel like they could have exploded while this man was in there and he wouldn't have blinked. It's like a lizard person. The clerk also said when the man left, he noticed the man had parked his car really far away from the store. And so the clerk thought that was kind of odd because it was a empty, quiet Sunday afternoon. The FBI then pulled surveillance from other stores in this same parking lot. One of them was a Party City, and they determined that the suspect had been driving a red 2002 Ford Ranger pickup truck with an extended cab. They couldn't get the license plate. It was too blurry of footage, but it was a start. There was also a Home Depot in the same shopping center. So the FBI pulled the surveillance footage from the Home Depot, and they found footage of a man buying red palmed gloves and a yard sign that said, "Drive like your kids live here." That same sign that had the fishing wire that detonated on Dong Song Drive. This time, the guy didn't have a disguise on, so they were able to get a better idea of what he looked like. He was a scrawny, young, white male with short, dark hair. Meanwhile, the FBI was running receipts from all over Austin that had any matching items for the components of the pipe bomb, and they were also running these names and cross-comparing them to vehicle registration information, trying to find this 2002 red pickup truck. So after they go through hundreds and hundreds of receipts, the FBI gets a hit. A man who had purchased components of a pipe bomb and had a red 2002 Ford Ranger pickup truck. 23-year-old Mark Anthony Condit. Mark Anthony Condit was identified as the suspect in the Austin serial bombings on March 20th, 2018 at 2:15 p.m. Condit was born on June 16th, 1994, and he had absolutely no prior criminal history. He didn't really have much social media presence either. He had been operating completely under the radar. By late on March 20th, police were quietly surveilling Condit Street in Pflugerville. This is a suburb north of Austin. It's a pretty quiet, unassuming, cute area, honestly. So this whole thing was just like really shocking, I'm sure, for everybody. They figured if they watched Condit for long enough, they could intercept the next attack and get an arrest. But while they were surveilling Condit's residence, something really weird happens. EMS unexpectedly arrived at the house. The FBI was obviously confused, and they ended up speaking with EMS, and they found out that someone had called 911. They were never able to figure out who called 911 or why, but clearly looking back, this was Condit's way of trying to get out of the situation. He knew that investigators were watching him. EMS had to check on the people in the house to make sure everyone was okay, and Condit had two roommates. They seemed to have no idea what was going on, but Condit also was not at home, so how would he have known to call EMS? Investigators also took note one roommate was an Asian male and the other was an African-American male. The roommates denied calling EMS and Condit was not at home. His truck was there, but he wasn't. So now the FBI has to figure out where the hell he is because they thought they had eyes on him this whole time. Then the FBI got a call that there had been another explosion. This time, it was at the Goodwill in South Austin. A man was burned by an artillery simulator device. This is an old military memento. It was in a donation box, and the man was taken to the St. David's South Austin Medical Center for treatment. The Austin Police Department announced via Twitter that this appeared unrelated to the serial bombings. So I was kind of confused by this, but from the sources I compiled, they made it sound like this explosion was a total accident and just a really, really weird coincidence, very unfortunate timing. But basically, someone had been making donations to Goodwill, and they didn't realize this device was even like capable of detonating. But luckily, everybody was okay. It was just like a really unfortunate distraction while they were trying to track down Condit. Early in the morning, on March 21st at 1:30 a.m., police did track down Mark Anthony Condit. He had been laying low at a hotel in Round Rock. This is another North Austin city, and it's close by to Pflugerville. He had driven there in a Nissan Pathfinder. Police kept eyes on Condit and waited for backup. When armored tactical vehicles arrived, they knew it was time to sweep in. But right as they were getting ready, Condit's Nissan Pathfinder started moving. Officers would follow Condit towards Interstate 35. Now, this is a major highway. There are thousands of people that are driving on this highway. So obviously, investigators were worried that Condit was going to hurt more people. So the SWAT officers acted quickly, and they ended up sandwiching Condit's car, forcing him to stop. SWAT officers then approached on foot, and while one officer attempted to smash the passenger window, the car exploded. Condit had blown himself up. He killed himself. The blast knocked the SWAT officer off his feet, but luckily he was not seriously injured. And when everything was over, 23-year-old Mark Anthony Condit was dead. Austin Police Chief Brian Manley stood in the darkness along Interstate 35 a short time later and said to the press, quote, "This is the culmination of 3 very long weeks for our community." President Trump also welcomed the news, saying in a tweet, in all caps, "Austin bombing suspect is dead. Great job by law enforcement and all concerned." In Condit's home, investigators found his blonde wig, bomb-making materials, and the red-palmed gloves. On Condit's phone, investigators also found a 25-minute video recording. This recording has never been released to the public, and there are some people who are pushing for that to happen. But apparently, in this 25-minute video, Condit describes the devices that he had built. He confessed to all the bombings. He talked about his life and how he self-identified as a sociopath, saying he had never felt empathy, and he did all of this because he wanted to feel something. Chief Manley held a press conference and said that the recording was, in his words, quote, "The outcry of a very challenged young man talking about challenges in his personal life that led him to this point." The chief also said Condit did not at all mention anything about terrorism, nor does he mention anything about hate. Condit's motive to this day officially remains unknown. Condit's family also later released a statement saying they were absolutely devastated and broken by the news and had no idea of the darkness that Mark had been living in. They also described their family as being normal in every way. So from what I could find, Condit grew up in a deeply religious Christian household in Pflugerville to his parents, Deneen and William Patrick Condit. He was homeschooled by his mom. He was the oldest of 3 kids, and he attended ACC, Austin Community College, from 2010 to 2012, but he did not end up graduating. He was also part of a group called the Righteous Invasion of Truth, also known as RIOT. This was a club for homeschooled kids who studied the Bible and practiced survivalism. In 2012, Condit wrote blog posts identifying himself as a conservative. He argued in favor of the death penalty, against same-sex marriage, and sex offender registries. This guy was against sex offender registries. He had no criminal record, and he worked for several years at a semiconductor company called Crux Manufacturing, but was fired 8 months before the bombings due to poor performance. He moved out of his parents' home a few years before the attacks, buying a house nearby with his father and living there with two roommates. And again, as far as the roommates go, they were detained for a while and they were questioned, but they were let go. They were not charged with any connection to Condit's crimes. I still think the whole EMS call thing is weird because if he wasn't home, then how did he know to like call EMS? I still don't really understand that. Not saying that that means the roommates were involved, but I do think it's a little weird. Jeremiah Jensen was one of the first people reporters called after Condit was identified. Jeremiah Jensen and Condit had been close in their late teens. They were part of the same homeschool community. They were members of the same church, Austin Stone Community Church. Their families would have lunch together after Sunday services. Jensen told KERA News that on the morning of March 21st, he woke up to about 10 reporters telling him that his friend was a serial murderer. He said Condit would be dominant and pugnacious in conversation and that he was kind of hard to be around. But according to him, as you got to know him, he would soften. He described Condit as a deep thinker, a philosophical person, athletic, but not into organized sports, and that he seemed happy. Jensen also said, quote, "I think that maybe he was lonely when he died, and I don't know why he did what he did. I don't know why he succumbed to hatred or the loneliness or the sadness. He's not a psychopath. Something broke in him, and I don't know what it was." So I think we've heard enough about the bomber and these rose-tinted glasses. Let's talk about the other side of this argument and how police and media have been treating Condit compared to the victims and compared to other suspects of domestic terrorism. When Chief Manley called Condit a very challenged young man in his initial press conference, the reaction was immediate and it cuts right to the heart of something that America still seems to be struggling with. Professor David Leonard, who studies critical race and gender studies at Washington State University, said about this, quote, "Here you have a case of a young white male who killed and injured multiple people of color and culturally more concerned about his story, about his life, about what led him to take these lives. It's a striking reminder of a racial empathy gap that persists," end quote. Sherilyn Ithill, then president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, tweeted in response to the chief's comments, quote, "I believe passionately in acknowledging the humanity of those who commit even terrible crimes. Reading this police chief's empathy for this young white man highlights the awfulness, the plain awfulness, of the persistent refusal to extend this empathy to young black people," end quote. Professor Caritha Mitchell of Ohio State said, quote, "Because we are determined to treat white men as citizens no matter what, to treat them as people who belong in the fold no matter what, that is the reason we will not use words like terrorist." And in fact, Chief Manley initially declined to label Condit a domestic terrorist because the video on his phone mentioned neither terrorism nor hate. The literal serial killer said he wasn't a terrorist and that he wasn't hateful, so I guess it must be true. Texas Governor Greg Abbott also wondered out loud whether Condit's goal was to terrorize or if he had some other type of agenda. It wasn't until March 29th, more than a week after Condit's death, for Chief Manley to reverse course and formally call the bombings domestic terrorism. How many times have we seen the opposite thing happen with people of color, where they're immediately labeled a thug or a terrorist? And we've seen similar things to how Mark Anthony Condit was treated. In the end, 5 bombs exploded over 19 days. 2 people died and 6 were injured. And the perpetrator killed himself in a cowardly manner instead of facing arrest. These attacks also led to new policies. FedEx implemented a new policy requiring all of their retail customers to show government-issued photo IDs, including a return address, before they're being allowed to ship packages. Condit's motive officially remains unknown. There is no manifesto. There's no stated ideology, just this mysterious 25-minute video that's never been released to the public. But what we do know is that Condit was full of hatred, and three families lost people that they loved. Stephen House, a father, a hard worker. Draylen Mason, a young musician who never got to play the concert he was preparing for. And there were several more that were severely injured and probably deeply traumatized. Stephen House's neighbor, Sean Phillips, the one who attempted to save his life that morning, later wrote a Facebook post about what he remembers from that day. To close out today's episode, I would like to read some of it to you. You're going to be surprised when I'm done that it's some. This is a very long post. I have whittled it down, believe it or not, but it tells a side of the story that I think needs to be heard. So I would recommend that you listen to this full thing. I do want to say, though, trigger warning for gore and violence. Quote, "Since March 2nd, when the first bomb went off and took the life of my neighbor, Stephen House, I have retold my side of the story well over 100 times. Each time, the story changes ever so slightly, not because of lies or exaggerations, but because recollecting what happened in detail is extremely difficult and painful. Images flash in my head. Bits and pieces of the story come forward that I didn't recall before. Hell, I'm not even certain that I remembered giving him two rescue breaths to get him breathing when I told the story on the first day. On day two, as soon as I remembered that fact, I could instantly taste Stefan's blood in my mouth. And that is a sensation that will never evade me. My thoughts always come out more clearly through my fingers than my mouth. So I decided I would write everything out as part of my own personal healing so that I can fully process it. The morning of Friday, March 2nd, started as any other weekday morning. My alarm went off at 6:45. I got up, woke the kids, and went downstairs to wait while they got ready for school. At approximately 6:50 a.m., I heard the loudest, most shocking noise I have likely ever heard. I can only describe it as sounding like a Mack truck had just hit a trash dumpster. I immediately ran outside to see what it was. I looked to the left, and I saw my next-door neighbor, Stephen, who happens to be the father of my daughter's best friend, standing, covered in blood, with shrapnel lodged all throughout his body and his hands nearly blown off. His face had a large gash on the lower side. It looked as if he was hit with an axe. He had a glazed-over look on his face, but his eyes were open. Within 5 seconds, he looked at me and collapsed onto his side. I ran to him, and I couldn't tell if he was breathing, so I gave him two rescue breaths. I couldn't do chest compressions, as his chest was full of shrapnel, and I feared I would lodge it in further if I did. I assume my rescue breaths helped, as he gasped as soon as I did them. I repeatedly yelled his name, but he was totally unresponsive. All around me, the neighborhood was in utter chaos, but I heard not a sound other than the sound of his gurgling blood. Meanwhile, there were screaming neighbors, and worse, the screams of, "My daddy is dead, my daddy is dead," coming from his little angel who saw him like that. I put him in the rescue position to try and keep him from drowning in his own blood before I called 911. I followed their instructions until EMS arrived approximately 2 minutes later. Simultaneously, but unnoticed by me at the time, another neighbor grabbed his daughter from inside the house and took her to his wife and his home. The first EMS person to arrive looked at him and said, "Is he even alive?" I responded, "Yes, he's breathing. Now why don't you keep it that way?" After EMS took him, I answered some questions to the fire and police agents that were there. Then I went back to my house and tried to go on with my day. In retrospect, I realize now that I was in complete shock at that time. Somehow, amidst all the chaos, I still managed to get my kids to school on time. On the ride, I explained that he was in a bad accident. I wasn't lying because at the time, that is what myself and the neighbors assumed. It had to be an accident, right? Who would even begin to think someone would be murdered with a bomb in boring-ass suburbia? My shock also had me convinced that he stood a fighting chance of making it. As I mentioned earlier, a neighbor ran into the house while I tended to the victim and grabbed his 8-year-old daughter. By the time he got her out, every neighbor was outside of their homes. One nice lady was a professional counselor and offered to keep Stefan's daughter distracted in her home with their infant daughter. As soon as I found out where she was, I went to check on her. At the time, she was happily watching Captain Underpants and playing with the baby. It was fucking surreal because she seemed to be calm and happy. Everything was calm and normal inside of this home, even though the street out front was complete chaos. Then I looked down and realized my pants were covered in blood, as were my hands, and I certainly didn't want her to see any of that. Myself and the other exiled neighbors were camped out in the front yard of the first house outside of the police tape. Someone brought out chairs and drinks, and we just hung out like that for hours. Most of the neighbors were fairly calm and even somewhat humorous. It was at this moment I realized I was traumatized. I thought to myself, how are these people making small talk? Why am I the only one that's sitting here shaking? As the day went on, a strange calm came over me. I talked with the neighbors. I called my shop and let them know I would not be in that day. I called my dad and let him know I was okay, in case he saw the news and recognized the street. I called my wife. After several hours, we were finally allowed back in the house. I took a shower and left pretty much immediately after. Shortly thereafter, I had to get my kids from school. When I dropped them off that morning, they knew that Stefan was hurt, but not that he died. Much less the fact that he was murdered with a goddamn bomb. This event has affected me more than any other in my 40 years on this rock. Over the next few days, I literally saw a bloody face in a hot sauce bottle. I had vivid flashbacks of how Stefan looked and other moments from that day. I would freeze up or jump at the slightest noise. As the days progressed and things started to get slightly better, there was another fucking bomb. Then a few short hours later, yet another. The police assured us that the bomb that killed Stefan was a targeted and isolated incident. With each additional bomb, I grew not only more fearful, but more guilt-ridden for believing any of that crap the police had fed us. I'm angry at the police for implying they were confident that it was a targeted attack that not only painted Stefan in an awful light, but it left the entire city with a false sense of security. Now that the bomber, and I refuse to give him the respect of using his name, had been stopped, a lot of people have asked me, are you glad he's dead? The answer to that question is a resounding no. The bomber had the opportunity to write his story from beginning to end. He got to choose when and how he died. Stefan and Draylen did not make that choice. He made it for them. A life sentence would have been far worse and a just fate for the bomber. In a blog post, the bomber said he was pro-death penalty and explained it by saying, "Living criminals harm and murder again. Executed ones do not." Unfortunately, justice will never be served because he got to end things on his own terms. Because of that, we may never know why he did it and how the victims' families, their friends, their neighbors, and the community at large can begin to move forward. The media has portrayed the bomber as a challenged young man. How was he challenged? He was educated. He lived in a nice neighborhood. Certainly, he had challenges in life, but so does everyone. And yet, the vast majority of us manage to deal with those challenges without senselessly murdering people. The bomber is a hate-filled monster, plain and simple. That's the only description that works for me. Here is the headline I would like to see. 23-year-old conservative Christian turns his hatred and judgments into a murderous bombing spree. Two good men died. Let's not let their deaths be in vain. Let us learn from the bomber that we cannot teach our children to hate and then act surprised when that hate manifests into violence. Let's teach them to love and see what that manifests into instead. End quote. So I told you guys that would be very long, but like, how often do we get to hear these stories from the perspective of the people who truly lived them? I feel like it was important to read that because it shows the power of community, how all of these people and this tight-knit community bands together to support each other, to help Stefan's daughter, how they were able to move forward and like go on about their days despite this trauma, these horrors. And then it shows the clear PTSD and the unspeakable things that these victims had to experience after the fact. I cannot imagine having to live through something like this. I will say, as someone who consumes a lot of true crime and like living in a big city, pretty much every time I go to like a festival, a mall, any like big crowded event, I'm constantly in fear of things like this happening, a mass shooting. And I feel like we have become way too desensitized to things like this. So I'm hoping that people who listen to this will get a better sense of what stuff like this does to people and how we can't just gloss over things and focus on the bomber and, oh, like, he must have been in so much pain. Why did he do what he did? Blah, 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 blah. I understand from a psychological perspective, wanting to understand why people do things like this, because then maybe we can somehow prevent it or look for signs. But if we're going to spend so much time talking about these people who commit crimes like this, at the very least, we should spend just as much, if not more time, honoring and talking about the victims. And like I said at the beginning of this episode, it was pretty hard to find information about them. So special thanks to the Darkness podcast for talking to loved ones and really giving me a lot of insight into these victims. So that, everybody, is today's perplexing episode about the Austin serial bombings. Thank you, everybody, for listening to today's episode. I still can't believe that I had never heard of this story. It absolutely reeled me, and it's just so horrifying and heartbreaking. Stephen House's family, Draylen Mason's family, Esperanza, all these victims. I can't imagine going through something like this. It's so troubling the way that police handled it initially, and then after the fact, waiting for so long to confirm that Condit was a domestic terrorist when he had literally killed multiple people with bombs. Like, obviously, that's what fucking happened. So it's just an important story, I think, to be talking about. I don't know. It just leaves me very deeply sad for these families. I don't know who's going to listen to this, but if any of these victims' loved ones, if anyone's listening that was around when this happened, I see you. I'm so sorry that you had to go through something like this. And I'm sorry that the police didn't handle this in the right way. This is my opinion, but I still do think that there is some type of racial motivation allegedly involved in these crimes. And clearly, Condit was a very hateful individual, a very closed-minded individual. And I do think statistically, if you look at crimes like this, there's a lot to be said about who commits them and what ideologies are harmful. So things to think about, just food for thought for everybody. But I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, interact in any way you can, hit all the buttons, share this episode. It really helps so much. If you're watching on YouTube, you can like this video, subscribe, drop a comment down below. What do you think about this case? If you're listening on Spotify, you can also comment. I want to hear what you guys think. If you have not left a 5-star review, please do that because it helps a ton. And if you want to support the show further, there's support links down in the episode description, my Patreon link, merch, buy me a coffee. That all helps a ton. My Perplexed Society members, you guys keep the lights on. Thank you. You are the number one reason I get to keep doing this podcast because I don't get paid to do this. You guys give me a little bit of money every month, and that is how I can pay for editing and all of the things that we need to keep doing this. I love telling you guys stories every week, so thank you. And if you can't support in that way, I also completely understand. I would just love if you interact, leave a review, and share the episodes. It really, really helps. But thank you, everybody, so much for listening. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.
Perplexity, a Mystery podcast, is hosted, written, and produced by me, Kadra Brannon. The show is proud to be a part of the Black Cat Network. Editing is by myself and Charlie Leopold. Theme song by Patrick Thompson. If you want ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content, you can always join the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. If you have a topic request or a listener story, you can always submit those to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com.
business inquiries can be sent via email. Additional support links, along with merch, can be found in the episode description. Until next week, stay curious.